From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The bloodshed continues in Iraq, with at least seven Marines killed yesterday alone. A bomb at the gates of Baghdad's Green Zone killed at least 13 Iraqis today. And President Ghazi al-Yawar has issued a dire warning that if things don't change soon, his country will be ripe for what he called an Iraqi Hitler to appear. Needless to say, a lot of hope is riding on Iraq's January 30th scheduled elections. The debate over whether the country is ready is intense and important, but in the background, behind the violence and the chaos, a political landscape has been taking shape. Now, on the anniversary of the capture of Saddam Hussein, we look at the politics shaping up in Iraq's first post-invasion election. Tonight on Point, election politics behind the mayhem in Iraq. We begin tonight in Baghdad. Alyssa Rubin is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's been covering Iraq's uncertain progress toward democracy. I asked her whether it was clear if the voting will go ahead on January 30th.
Well, I think right now it certainly looks as if the vote will go ahead. The interim Iraqi government is certainly saying that, both the prime minister and the president. Most of the Shia members, particularly of the National Assembly, want to see it go ahead. The Americans have certainly also said they think it should go ahead. There is some concern that there's sort of no legal provision for what happens if it doesn't go ahead. I mean, it's not clear what the status of the government would be and all kinds of things. So there's a strong feeling that it needs to go ahead. However, there are a lot of Sunnis in the country, both Sunni political parties, some Sunni politicians, who are very upset. They don't feel that they're going to be adequately represented. It's very violent in some Sunni areas. There are threats for many people in Sunni areas if they were to go ahead and try to go to the polls. And so they feel they'll be quite disadvantaged in the election. And so there is a lot of opposition to going ahead on the 30th. But nonetheless, I think unless there is really a significant increase in violence, the tables are sort of laid for it to all go forward.
Alyssa, remind us, if you would, exactly what choices Iraqis will make in the voting booth. What will they be voting for?
They'll be voting for a slate of candidates. This is quite a different system from the American system. Groups of candidates get together and offer a complete slate of 275 members who would represent the country in a transitional National Assembly. So you go in and you pick the combination of candidates, in essence, that you most like. You don't pick by individual. You don't pick by geographic area. This slate would represent the whole country.
And this transitional National Assembly will then craft Iraq's new permanent constitution.
Well, they will actually do two things. First of all, they will pick a government, which is not insignificant. And then they will also come up with the people who will actually do the drafting of the Constitution. But presumably, since they pick the people, they will also be involved in it. I think it would be unwieldy probably to have all 275 people in the National Assembly involved in writing a Constitution.
So essentially, each voter will give one big vote for one of these complete slates that's presented. Is that the idea?
Exactly. And then depending on how many votes each slate gets, let's say the slate A gets 20% of the votes, then 20%, as I understand it, and it's quite complicated, but I believe the top 20% of people on that slate would be in the transitional assembly. The slates that get 5% would have their top 5% in the transitional National Assembly. You're going to get individuals, but you're not going to actually be voting specifically for those individuals.
So being on a winning slate and being high on the list is very important. What kind of slates are emerging? What sort of profiles do these different slates of candidates have?
Well, there actually are a lot of different kinds of slates. The slate that's probably gotten the most attention is the so-called Unified Iraqi Alliance, which is a slate primarily made up of Shia, with some links to Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani and the Marja'iyya in Najaf. But it's not exclusively a Shia slate. They do have some significant Sunni representatives on the slate, although a small number, some Kurds, Shia Kurds in this case, some Yazidis who are early Christian sect that doesn't exist elsewhere but would not identify as Christians, and a couple of other Turkmen groups. but it's predominantly Shia, and many of the people on the slate have a religious bent, although not all of them.
The Shia, of course, make up 60% of Iraq's population, but have not had power. If they win a dominating position in this transitional National Assembly, it would be the first time that they have a significant share of power in the country's history. Are they positioned to get that big, powerful position?
I think they're positioned to do very well. I think how well is unclear yet. And there are also likely to be, it's unclear exactly how Prime Minister Alawi and President Yaour will run, but it's possible they will form a combined slate. It wouldn't really be Sunni or Shia. It would really be a sort of a secular, Western-leaning slate. There are some regional slates where I think the people are counting on people from their part of the country, their province, to vote for them. These slates probably won't win anywhere near as many seats, but they could win enough to have a voice in the assembly. I believe the governor of Diyala is going to have a slate, for instance. It's possible that the Sunni Islamic Party will present its slate. It's not actually what it's called, the Iraqi Islamic Party, but it's vastly Sunni. They would probably have Sunnis from several different places in the country. So there are a variety of different slates out there that are emerging.
The big question seems to be whether enough Sunnis participate in this election that it can be seen as legitimate overall, that it's not flawed by their staying away from the polls. How does that look at this point?
Well, I really think that is the great, you know, sort of $64,000 question that none of us know the answer to. And there are two views. And one is that Sunnis will stay away from the polls for the most part, or in many parts of the country, and that would result in enormous resentment in the Sunni community and probably bolster the insurgency. And the other view is that at the end of the day, on election day, Sunnis will choose to come to the polls because they know that because Shiites chose not to be involved in politics and to shun the British occupation in 1920, they really were written out of power for the rest of the century. And that was a terrible decision for them politically and culturally and economically. Mm. And Sunnis want to avoid that themselves. And so they will in the end say, look, if everybody else is going to vote, I'm going to vote too and at least have my voice heard. I think it's anybody's guess which will happen. Obviously, the interim Iraqi government, which is pushing forward with the election, and the Americans are gambling that it'll be the latter and the Sunnis will vote. But I think we won't know until we get there.
And the final question, Alyssa, of course, legitimacy also depends on enough Iraqis feeling safe enough to come out and vote. The security issue will be very large. How does that look at this point? Will Iraqis be able to get to the polls and vote without risking death or dying?
Well, I think in many places they will be able to. It sounds rather cold, but if you look at sort of the best days for the insurgents, maybe involve 100 attacks. There are going to be 9,000 polling stations. It will be horrible at some places, almost undoubtedly. But whether it will really inhibit voting overall is very difficult to say. Both the South and the North, Kurdistan, are relatively stable right now. And it is expected that while there might be scattered incidents there, they would not be enough to keep large numbers of people away from the polls.
Alyssa Rubin, thank you so much for joining us. You're just terrific there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Alyssa Rubin is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Baghdad. We are talking tonight about election politics beyond the chaos in Iraq, if there can be politics beyond that chaos, and about the political power plays underway as the country struggles toward the January 30th elections. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you believe the election will happen on schedule? Do you see Iraq headed toward a glimmer of democracy or toward civil war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Ambassador Peter Galbraith. He is Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington. As a staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the 1980s, he uncovered Iraq's infamous Anfal campaign of ethnic cleansing against the Kurds. He left Iraq less than a week ago and joins us tonight from Stockholm, Sweden. Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
And also with us tonight from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Juan Cole, Professor of Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. Juan Cole, wonderful to have you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So here we are. The violence goes on every day and very heavy this weekend. Juan Cole, but first to you, what are the forces that you see coalescing as we go toward this election? Slates are being put together, Kurd, Shiite, some Sunni, and some mixtures of that and more? Does it look like a political landscape emerging that can A, hold these elections and B, profit from it, move closer to stability?
Well, I think the elections will likely be a major destabilizing event. The way the elections have been structured is that these lists of candidates, which are ranked lists 1 through, say, 275,
yes,
will be seated in proportion of their national vote.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the list put together at the behest of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the United Iraqi Alliance.
A fundamentally Shia list.
Mainly Shiite, heavily dominated by Shiite religious parties,
mm-hmm.
Although it also has a large number of Shiite independents, but they're clients of Sistani. If they get, if that list gets 52% of the vote, then about half of their delegates, the first half, will be seated in the parliament. And since it's a single chamber legislature,
mm-hmm.
they will dominate it. And if the Sunni Arabs boycott, or if security issues prevent them from getting to the polls in sufficient numbers,
mm-hmm.
they will inevitably get less than their 20% of the seats in parliament by the proportion of population that they represent. And since the parliament is not only a parliament, but also a constitutional assembly, and will craft a permanent constitution for the country, if the Sunni Arabs are more or less cut out of the constitution making, then you've got the fixings for a guerrilla war sometime into the future.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, the Bush administration and others have been pointing to January 30th as the potential godsend, as the all-important date when elections must happen if Iraq is to stay on track towards some kind of stability. Juan Cole saying it may have just the opposite effect. How do you see it?
Oh, I agree entirely with Juan Cole. The Bush administration has fixated on the elections because it's looking for some event that can justify what it has done over the last couple of years, and because it hopes that this might be the transition to greater stability. But the problem with Iraq from day one has been, in essence, a lack of Iraqis, a lack of people who think primarily in terms of the entire nation. And these elections will be dominated by two slates, the Shiite slate put together by the Ayatollah Sistani, which revolves around the Shiite identity and whose agenda is to both to empower a group that has been out of power for 80 years, whose agenda is to create an Islamic state, and a single Kurdish slate will undoubtedly come in second. It involves all the parties in Kurdistan, the two main traditional Kurdish political parties, but the groups including the Communists and the Kurdish Islamic Party. And their agenda will be to defend the de facto independence of Kurdistan and to preserve the secular identity of Kurdistan. You'll have two large slates with diametrically opposed views on the future of the country.
And with the 20% Sunni population, you're saying if these two groups are so heavily represented, the Sunnis will barely be represented.
Well, it's the same problem that Juan Cole described, which is that if you in this system, which is a single nationwide electoral district with people represented on a proportional representation basis, if you don't vote, you're not represented. There may well be a boycott called by the Sunni political parties and religious leaders, but even if there's no boycott, it may be much too dangerous to vote. It's not only that violence could disrupt the voting in the Sunni areas, it is that if you go and vote, you'll be on a list of people who voted, and you could be targeted by insurgents who know that it's in their interest to prevent voting by Sunni Arabs because it will breed the resentment against. They know that if the Sunni Arabs are disenfranchised, it will continue the resentment against the new Iraqi government.
The new government, and yet all hopes seem to hang on these elections. Peter Galbraith, Juan Cole, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about election politics behind the mayhem in Iraq as that country approaches a scheduled national vote on January 30th, a vote that Washington and the White House have pinned a lot on. Our guests tonight are skeptical. You can join this conversation. What's the outcome that Iraq needs on January 30th or beyond to have a prayer of peace and stability? Do you believe the January 30th elections will happen? Is there enough security to pull them off? Will enough Sunnis participate to make it an all-Iraq event? Do you see Iraq headed toward a glimmer of democracy here or civil war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Juan Cole, I have to admit, speaking with you and Peter Galbraith, it's confusing because the unified message pretty much out of Washington is that these elections are absolutely imperative, even if things are, to use a Rumsfeld term, messy in Iraq, and we know what that means, very bloody and chaotic, that these have to go ahead or things risk being derailed to a huge extent, to an extent that people can't recover. Even Tom Friedman in the New York Times constantly saying how important these elections are. Is there no scenario you can see under which it's less gloomy, under which these elections actually get Iraq on a better track?
Well, I think it's too late. I mean, there were possible scenarios. For instance, if Sistani had been a true statesman, he should have set up his list with 20% Sunni Arab representation.
Included in it, baked into it.
Included in it. Mm-hmm. And then he would have been a national hero, and he would have been able to put together a government that would speak for all of Iraq. I think he'd have enormous gratitude from the whole country. But he didn't do it that way. He did it on a sectarian basis, and I have to say that my opinion of him slipped because of that. I mean, you know, the real problem here is that the Americans refused refused to make any of them. And they dumped all those decisions off on this new parliament that's going to be elected. So first, let's say everything goes all right and you actually do get an elected parliament.
Yeah.
The first thing that parliament is going to do is to open all the cans of worms in Iraq simultaneously. They have to decide what's going to happen to the oil city of Kirkuk, which is claimed by the Kurds and the Turkmen and the Arabs. They have to decide if the Kurds are going to get a united super province of Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. They have to decide if there are going to be similar aggregations of Shiite provinces. They have to decide, is there going to be Islamic law or secular law? What are the rights of women? And the Americans have set things up with a time bomb so that all those debates have to happen in February, March, and April. And moreover, they have set it up so that they may well happen in the absence of one of the major ethnic groups in Iraq.
They have to happen in February, March, and April because that's the timetable toward writing the Constitution.
That's right.
Juan Cole, can you see a scenario in which the Sunnis, even in the last weeks or days, spread the word, hey, we cannot afford to be left out of this. The Shia did that, 80 years ago, and were frozen out for the better part of a century. We've got to get to the polls, and they go.
Well, everything is possible. But, you know, we have seen elections like those in Peru where people were threatened by the Sendero Luminoso and they nevertheless came out and voted. So it's not impossible. But we also have other scenarios. For instance, in Bahrain a couple years ago, there were finally elections, and the majority of Bahrainis are Shiites, and they didn't like the way that the elections were set up. And so the majority community actually stayed home and boycotted, and Sunni fundamentalists, who are a tiny minority in Bahrain, ended up dominating parliament. So very bad outcomes can occur in these situations. People don't necessarily act rationally.
Peter Galbraith, what about your perspective? Can you see the Sunnis at the last minute saying, we've got to be involved here, and actually coming out to the vote, achieving a reasonable representation of their population in the electoral outcome?
I think that's possible, but not likely. But even if that occurs, the problem will remain the division of the country between a majority Shiite bloc, all which are united behind creating a Shiite Islamic State, and others, notably the Kurds, who have significant military power and who have been de facto independent, who will refuse to accept such an outcome.
Peter Galbraith, Juan Cole, I want to bring another voice into this conversation, a voice of someone directly involved in the election politics in Iraq right now. Ghassan Atiyah is founder of the Iraqi Foundation for Development and Democracy. It's an organization that has been supported in part by the International Republican Institute in Washington. Ghassan Atiyah is working to mount a secular slate of candidates for the upcoming vote. I spoke with him earlier. He's in Baghdad. I asked him if he thought the elections should go ahead on January 30th.
We can take enough measures to make sure that the election will be comprehensive and all parts of Iraq will participate in it, then it is advisable we postpone it for a month or two, provided this decision will come out of consensus and will not appear as if being dictated by one party against others.
So as things stand right now, are you recommending a delay of a month or two?
I tried my best before the Sharm el-Sheikh conference and even in Washington to point out that election is not an end by itself. It's a mean. And election is basically, especially in countries out of dictatorship and civil war, are a very tricky subject. Bad election could lead to worse results. We don't have to look far away to Cambodia or Angola or even Bosnia after the Dayton Agreement, but you can look to what happened in Kurdistan. In 1992, they had election. It was a bad election. It was followed a year later by Kurdish-Kurdish civil war, and which left Kurdistan divided until today. So we have to be very cautious that we need an election which will be recognized and will legitimize the result, and the result should be accepted by the majority of the Iraqi and not be contested as illegitimate.
Ghassan Atiyah, can you describe for us what role is your group, the Iraqi Foundation for Development and Democracy, what role are you playing in the politics pushing toward this election? Are you putting up your own slate of candidates?
The foundation itself is a continuation of what I've been doing when I was in exile for more than 18 years in Europe. And we try to inject a sense of liberalism and secularism in our approach to the Iraqi issues as a think tank. Unfortunately, we were overwhelmed with events, and there is more emphasis now how we can change things or how can make a difference in what's happening in Iraq. A group of Iraqis who are frustrated and rather unhappy with the performance of the CPA and the American administration, as well as with the Iraqi governing council and the present government, and they are not happy with the kind of polarization in the Iraqi society, and we thought at least we will stand for election as a group with clear issues rather than sect or ethnic groupings, and stand for the principle that democracy without Democrats is not a viable object. Thus, we were able to group a slate of Iraqis, maybe to surprise of so many people. They include Sunnis and Shi'i, as well as Christian and Kurds, and it represents people from different provinces of Iraq, and even people from Ramadi and Fallujah, or what they called the Sunni Triangle. Thus, we felt that we are duty-bound to present the Iraqi with a choice, and I hope the Iraqi people will pick this choice and will understand this gesture, where for the first time you can see that Shia and Sunni working together on a democratic, secular basis.
So in the middle of a great contest of religious-oriented politics and ethnic-oriented politics, you're putting up a liberal, secular slate. Do you have a chance to get your message out to the Iraqi people? Given all the unrest there, is it possible to campaign in advance of this election?
Listen, you are absolutely right. That's why I, among others, we feel a delay in the election will harm no one. If the Shia feels they have the majority and they can win, so why they are worried? Like they could even give the Sunnis 2 or 3 months and then they will even win, but at least they will be more legitimate and recognize victory. So actually, if things will continue the way it is being done, I don't see how violence will recede, but I will see that we will enter in a period where the last hope we have, an agreed principle that election could resolve our conflict from the street and convey it to the parliament. And I feel there's no logic in insisting that the date has to be sacrosanct. What is the rush if we cannot, as the component of the Iraqi people, sit around the round table, as was suggested by Bahrain in Sharm el Sheikh meeting during the last month, and then we could meet after a taste of trouble and violence for the last 17 months, which convinced every Iraqi that we need help outside. I know that if the U.S. administration was in agreement with this idea, they would have put their weight on the Iraqi government to accept the idea. But unfortunately, they didn't.
Ghassan Atiyah, we wish you the best of luck there, and we're very grateful to you for speaking with us tonight.
Thank you. Good night.
Ghassan Atiyah, founder of the Iraqi Foundation for Development and Democracy, he spoke with me from Baghdad. We're joined tonight by Ambassador Peter Galbraith, joining us from Stockholm, Sweden, just back from Iraq, and by Juan Cole, professor of Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan, joining us tonight from Ann Arbor. Peter Galbraith, as you listen to Ghassan Atiyah in the thick of it there, he's saying, let's put this off. Let's not rush this. Just 2 or 3 months. But I think the attitude often expressed in the States is this is only going to get more unstable. We need to go ahead and get this done. What advantage could be gained? You've also asked for a delay. What advantage could be gained with a delay of 2 or 3 months in these scheduled elections?
None if the elections go ahead on the basis of the same system. But what Les Gelb and I have called for is to go ahead and hold elections for regional governments in Kurdistan and in the southern Shiite governorates, which then might form one or two regions. Let those regions get on with the business of running their own affairs, and let them then start a process of negotiating as regions the relationship amongst each other and what powers might be at the center. The process of doing that, I think, first, it could reassure the Sunni Arabs that there's going to be a region preserved for them, that when the situation allows, they can hold elections there. They won't be shut out of the process as they would be under this system, and that might indeed prove an incentive for them to get organized so that they can have elections in the Sunni Triangle.
Juan Cole, what about it? Peter Galbraith suggests let's go to regional elections first. Don't try to push this to a national solution right away. What do you say?
Well, you have to deal with the political forces on the ground. The Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani wants the elections held on January 30th, and as long as that is his firm position, then they're likely to be held then.
Because we saw what happened when he was unhappy earlier, when Muqtada al-Sadr was sort of unleashed and we had fighting all up and down the Shia zone.
Well, Sistani wasn't responsible for Muqtada, but last January when Paul Bremer, the American administrator, mm-hmm. tried to buck Sistani on the issue of having one person, one vote elections, Sistani just waved his hand and brought hundreds of thousands of people out into the street. So the Americans have ended up being like a skier on one ski in Iraq. They don't have the Sunni Arabs with them. And the majority of the country is Shiite, and they defer to Sistani on things like this. So the Americans have no choice but to try to keep Sistani happy. And we're Sistani to decide that the Americans are not going to give him what he wants and turn against them, then all hell would break loose. So I think the Americans are locked into these elections as long as Sistani wants them held in this way at this time, and that the only thing that we can hope is that the emerging Shiite political leadership, which will be a national leadership, will have the wisdom to find a way to reach out then to the Kurds and the Sunni Arabs and mollify them.
The U.S. locked right into the state. Of course, the White House says that's exactly where it wants to be. Juan Cole, Peter Galbraith, please stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is calling from West Salem, Wisconsin. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Hey, Mr. Galbraith, thanks for years of sanity in international relations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that, you know, the situation we're in right now, if we do not take number one, a regional approach first, which would take years to build up to national elections. You know, we're talking 5 to 10 years here. We would have a repeat of Yugoslavia because I think that given the political forces in play right now, you have three proportional groups, and neither one of them is going to be happy with the outcome that currently looks like, with the Shias taking a majority and the Kurds possibly losing some autonomy, and the Sunnis, you know, somewhere out in left field, because I think they will abstain from the elections.
But George, if you put a national election off for years, how do you resist the centrifugal forces in this country without a legitimated central government?
Well, that's the crux of the problem. I think if we try to push a national election now, what is going to wind up happening is the facilitation of the disruption of the entire system in the country, and maybe that should be looked at. I know Larry Diamond had an article in Foreign Policy magazine where he kind of broached that concept a couple months ago, and he said, look, instead of presiding over trying to unite this thing that has capabilities to be like Yugoslavia, why don't instead we preside over the disruption or the disunion of it right now and conduct a managed separation of the various parts of Iraq? And I'll stop there and listen.
George, thanks for your call. Peter Galbraith, this seems to be kind of the tune that you've been singing, which is let the separate sections be separate, at least for a while. Sunni, Shia, Kurd.
Well, George has some very valid points. The first is that the outcome of the election cannot just be satisfactory to the majority. What results from it in a constitution has to be satisfactory to each of the groups, to the Shiites, to the Sunnis, and to the Kurds. And certainly the Kurds, who have an army and have their own government, will not accept anything except a situation where they continue to be de facto independent. And there's going to be no power in the Shiite part of Iraq that will be able actually to take control of Kurdistan. And the Sunni Arabs will also fear domination by the Shiites. In some sense, Iraq has already broken up. And so I agree with the idea that what we ought to be doing is having a managed disunion so that there is not a civil war, not for three fully independent countries with flags of the United Nations, but a loose confederation in which each of these three groups can feel secure, and in which over time they may see advantages to working together, particularly in the exploitation of Iraq's very significant oil wealth.
And you think that Al-Sistani thinks he can dominate the Sunni perpetually if the Shia win? Big representation?
I think that is part of the problem, that this is a country without any experience of democracy except for the Kurdish elections in 1992, and the Arab parties tend to see things in absolute terms. That is, if they win, they get to dominate the entire country.
Peter Galbraith, Juan Cole, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about election politics behind the mayhem in Iraq. Listeners, you can join this conversation. Is Washington prepared to accept whatever the Iraqis elect, secular, Islamist, regionalist? And is President Bush right to insist that elections go ahead, whatever the levels of violence and chaos? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about election politics behind and inside the mayhem right now in Iraq. You can join this conversation tonight. What's your confidence that after a January 30th election, Iraq will be on a viable path to stability? And would you have the guts to go out and vote on Election Day in Baghdad, in Mosul, the guts to run for office in Iraq as things stand there? And do we have one nation here, or maybe three? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Stockholm, Sweden, by Ambassador Peter Galbraith, recently out of Iraq. He's Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And from Ann Arbor, Michigan tonight, by Professor Juan Cole, Professor of Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. Right now from La Crosse, Wisconsin, by Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be among such distinguished company, including yourself this evening, Tom.
Good to have you, Joe. What's on your mind?
I'd like to say I noticed that there's not a lot of discussion with what's going on with the Bush administration's position right now. And I think apart from simply reiterating that, you know, elections should go on, we need to do this, we need to do this, I think we're in the same situation we were in before the war was over. We had no post-war strategy, and now we don't really have a post-election strategy. We're simply kind of, you know, taking it by the bootstraps here. And I think we need to sit down and rationally think about what are the possible consequences of what's going to happen on the election. I think the idea of organized disunion that they were just talking about is a serious strategy that needs to be given a lot of thought and a lot of talk about how we can best suit the needs of this country to the democracy or such as it is that they're about to receive.
And yet we're not hearing much or anything about that. And I've been sitting here with the same question you're raising, Joe, and I thank you for raising it. Let me go, Juan Cole, to you first. If you and Peter Galbraith are correct, if it's so bad to go ahead with these elections, and if dire consequences will emerge so quickly, within weeks or months, both of you are saying, then why is the White House pushing in this direction? Do you see a strategic plan that's simply different from your perspective, but that's there?
Well, I think the White House is pushing for the elections because the elections were demanded by the majority Shiites, and they feel they have no recourse but to cooperate. The Bush administration never wanted to have one-person, one-vote elections in the first place. They wanted to massage something into existence from their kind of appointed regional councils, and Sistani was the one who stopped that. So with regard to what could be done, well, I have proposed that we have a one-time set-aside of 20-25% of seats in Parliament for the Sunni Arab candidates. So I'd leapfrog the Sunni Arab candidates from the various lists.
So you're going to be in Sunnis whether you participate or not?
Well, what I'm saying is there will be a substantial number of Sunni Arab candidates on these various lists.
Yeah.
And I would simply set aside 25% of the seats, say 55 seats,
right,
for them. And I would say the top-ranked 55 get in. And, you know, the women are being treated this way. There's a 30% set-aside of seats for women.
Do you think al-Sistani would agree to that kind of arrangement?
Yeah, I believe he would.
Really?
In fact, his spokesman, Hossein Shahrastani, has said that if the parliament ends up being grossly unbalanced against the Sunnis, that retroactive steps would be taken by parliament to rectify it. I think the steps would be more easily taken beforehand. Now, I'm not suggesting this as a system. I'm saying for one time only.
Mm-hmm.
Put the Sunnis in proportion so that then they can have a seat at the constitution making. I, by the way, am not in favor of regionalism or breaking up Iraq or de facto breaking it up with a kind of federal facade that's very weak. I think that you're in danger with that kind of thing of an enormous ethnic cleansing on the scale of what happened in India and Pakistan in 1947. Mm. There are a million Sunni Arabs in the south. There are a million Kurds in the Baghdad province. There are 700,000 Turkmen in the Kurdish areas. Kirkuk is a city that has about one-third each Turkmen, Arabs, and Kurds, over which there could easily be fighting.
Just can't disentangle it, you're saying.
If you try to disentangle it politically, you risk tearing the country apart, and this could spill over. If you had this kind of semi-autonomous Shiite South in this Shiite state in the South,
yes.
What if it got taken over by people like Muqtada Sadr? That's where most of the petroleum is.
Mm-hmm.
And what if they then extended their influence into the largely Shiite Al-Hasa province of Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
which is where most of the Saudi oil is?
Right, right.
I mean, you're talking about a potential for the kind of disruption of the Persian Gulf politics that could throw the whole world into another depression.
Go down that road and you could have a real calamity. Peter Galbraith, I'm sure you want to respond to that, but if you just take up first Juan Cole's notion here of a one-time set-aside for the Sunni, drawn off of lists so they're real candidates, but as for Iraqi women, so there would be a guaranteed a proportional presence of Sunni in this first transitional National Assembly. A, can you imagine that working? And B, do you have any inkling that Washington might be thinking along those lines?
First, I don't see it happening. And secondly, I don't see that it solves the problem for the Sunni Arabs.
Why not? They'd be represented in proportion to their numbers.
Well, they aren't going to be represented because they aren't going to be represented by people that they themselves chose. They would be represented only by people who happen to be Sunni Arabs. And that's not the issue.
Not the same.
The issue is to have their own voice that they themselves choose.
So even as a kind of cosmetic way forward, you don't think it would work. What about Juan Cole's concern about this notion? I think our caller described it organized disunion, at least for a while. He says that's a path to to calamity, you clearly think not. Why not?
Well, I think trying to put the country back together again as a unified state will produce much more violence than accepting that Kurdistan already runs its own affairs, already is de facto independent, accepting that the South basically is also already running its own affairs and developing a system that begins with that as the basis. But there is no doubt that even developing a confederation, it is going to involve some very difficult problems that the Bush administration has very much ignored. One of them is the disposition of the city of Kirkuk and the related areas that have a lot of oil that is contested among Kurds, Turkmens, and Arabs.
Right.
There is the problem of Baghdad. But Iraq is not a multi-ethnic state in the sense it's a multi-ethnic state, but it's not a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
And even in these areas that are multi-ethnic, like Baghdad, these communities largely live in their own areas.
So you're saying they could be teased apart. Juan Cole, you're just not buying it. Now we should say you're the great Shia expert, Juan Cole. Peter Galbraith has worked very closely with the Kurds. In a way, I'm hearing parties represented in this conversation. Are you bringing a partisan agenda, Juan Cole, in your way of looking at it?
Well, I just don't, aside from some of the more extreme Kurds, I don't hear any major Iraqi political force talking about the kinds of things that Peter Galbraith is talking about. That is to say, I greatly respect his experience and his knowledge and his long years of working with the Kurds.
And surely the Kurds are talking a lot about autonomy.
No, not about autonomy.
Really?
There's a difference between autonomy and semi-autonomy.
Okay.
What the Kurds, I mean, the maximalist demand of the Kurds is that they get to keep the lion's share of oil resources in their province. They say that this is the Canadian model. They want no federal troops to set foot on their soil.
Mm.
They want devolution of certain things like education and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you think about it seriously, a lot of what they're asking for is what the states' rights people in Alabama ask for from the federal government. Much of it is not terribly unreasonable, and I personally think that there's every evidence that a lot of the Shiite political groups would be perfectly willing to grant a good deal of it, not everything. But I don't think that the problems between the Shiites' majority and the Kurds are insuperable. And moreover, I think that this thing about Kirkuk Petroleum and so forth is a not an issue that has long legs. Those
a lot of oil, a lot of money.
Well, they only pump 200,000 barrels a day, and they're declining. The real oil wealth and the oil future of Iraq lies in the south. There's Rumaila. There are a number of unexplored fields that we know about. And if I were a Kurd and I had a choice between being stuck with my own little country up there in the north in the mountains with no real income and ending up like Tajikistan or hitching myself to some kind of federal Iraq, in which I shared in the potential oil wealth of the future, I'd want to be with Baghdad, but I'd want to be with Baghdad on my terms, and I think that they can get most of their terms.
Fascinating kind of proxy conversation to some extent here. Fred is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I had a question about Kurdistan, which you have just sort of gotten into, and it involves the Kurds and Turkey. And the question would be, what is going to happen if the Kurds do demand a sufficient degree of autonomy that they cannot get it, even with the amount of votes that they get in the election?
Because Turkey won't permit it, you mean? Turkey would intervene?
And Turkey may intervene, and the Kurds, having really the only effective standing army in that area, as I understand it, other than the United States, have some power to try to enforce what they want. What then is Turkey going to do, and what would the United States possibly do about it, considering the fact that our troops are already stretched and that NATO, you know, Turkey is an ally?
But doesn't want to be involved. Fred, it's a great question. Peter Galbraith, let me put that to you. If Kurds got the kind of autonomy, semi-autonomy, temporary semi-autonomy, call it what you will, that you're describing, what's Turkey's reaction?
Well, first, just to make to comment on what Juan Cole has said.
Yes.
Indeed, if Kurdistan has the powers that he describes, that is, controls its own oil, can make its own laws, no federal troops going into Kurdistan, I think that that is a workable outcome. But one has to keep in mind that there are almost no Kurds who in their heart want to be Iraqi. Indeed, in January this year, 1.7 million Kurds signed a petition asking for a vote on independence. That's more than 80% of the adults. And that's the sentiment in their heart of all the top Kurdish leaders, even though they're moderate in their political demands. Now, the reason that the leaders don't push for independence is because of the neighbors, and in particular, because of Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But Turkey's options are rather limited. It's just about to get a date to begin talks to join the European Union. Turkey knows full well that if it were to send troops into Kurdistan to try and block a Kurdish autonomy, that it would never, those talks would end, that it would, they would never get into the European Union. They've had the experience of Cyprus. It's easy to invade a place. It's very tough to ever get out. And there's also some change in thinking in Turkey about this question, because some people are beginning to see the Iraqi Kurds as sharing a lot of the same values that Turkey has, that is Western-oriented, democratic, and above all, secular.
Peter Gammoth, let me intervene for just...
The Kurds as an enemy, as a potential buffer against a radical Islamic state dominated by the Shiites.
Let me intervene for just a moment, because our time is so short, and this conversation has gone a long way off of that January 30th election that's still standing there. The White House, Washington, still pushing hard toward it, insisting that that's the next step. If this goes ahead, if it's successful, which in itself is an open question, but if it goes ahead, it's successful, what do you anticipate in the weeks and months following January 30th?
Well, I think you're going to see two different groups in the assembly, as the Shiite list, a Kurdish list. There aren't going to be any significant all-Iraq communities. And the question will be, will the Shiites, in fact, accept the degree of autonomy that Kurdistan now has? Will they accept that Kurdistan will not be part of the Islamic State, that, yes, Islam may be the principal source of law in Arab Iraq, but not in Kurdistan? If they can do that, then perhaps you'll have some kind of agreement on a constitution. If not, I'm afraid that the Shiites may go ahead and decide to write the constitution themselves and ignore a provision of the interim constitution that, in effect, gives Kurdistan and the Sunni Arabs a veto. Mm. If they go ahead with that, then I think the Kurds will pull out of Baghdad, and you're going to be on the verge of a civil war.
Juan Cole, do you fear that, or do you see, we just got 20 seconds here, do you see the Shia being bigger statesmen than that, ultimately?
Well, I think the Shia are just too weak to try to impose themselves on the whole country in that way. They don't have a military force of any significance the way the Kurds do. I think the Kurds are in a very good bargaining position to continue with their own projects as long as they don't declare complete independence. But I do think that the dangers of substantial communal turmoil, of rioting in Kirkuk that could get out of hand, could threaten the Turkmen in such a way as to enrage Turkish public opinion.
Sitting right there is a possibility. With that, Juan Cole, I'm sorry that we're out of time, but we're so grateful to you for being with us tonight. Juan Cole at the University of Michigan and Ambassador Peter Galbraith with us tonight from Stockholm, Sweden. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.